Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Michael's Saturday Night Surprise for January 6th, 2018. My name is Bob Braxma. I'm your host tonight, and I'm going to introduce you to two shows called Masterminds.
He was the greatest smuggler in American history.
No, he was very shrewd. He was very smart. He was very calculating.
His customized superplane evaded sophisticated radar and outran government air patrols.
He's an outstanding pilot.
And landed tons of drugs in the last place authorities expected.
Compared to anyone else in the drug business, he was a genius.
Find out how he did it next on Masterminds. In the early 1980s, the Reagan administration declared war on drug smugglers.
Our commitment to this program is unshakable.
Colombian drug cartels were hiring Americans to fly their narcotics into the U.S. Authorities identified Florida as the main point of entry and learned the smugglers fit a consistent profile.
The individuals with the flashy gold and the watches and as I refer to as the Miami Vice type they want to almost advertise that I am a drug smuggler.
Customs and Drug Enforcement agents targeted these smugglers.
The government subsequently put more agents down in Florida to combat this.
A secret network of sophisticated radar was installed throughout Florida and the Gulf Coast.
The government also put up a bunch of planes that were basically flying radar systems designed to catch drug smugglers.
Air patrols created a massive dragnet over land and sea. All suspicious vessels were tracked and targeted.
80% of your risk of being arrested is entering the shoreline of the United States, being intercepted by Customs or DEA.
Authorities' efforts paid off. Drug rings were busted. Tons of narcotics were confiscated. Millions of dollars were recovered. And the smugglers themselves were chased out of the sky.
If you looked around down in Miami and down around off the Bahamas, all you're going to see is crashed airplanes.
In spite of their success, however, the DEA realized one smuggler was eluding their security net and landing billions of dollars worth of cocaine. They launched a massive manhunt.
This investigation was considered the number one case in DEA worldwide.
But authorities couldn't find him because they were looking in the wrong place. This smuggler didn't operate out of Florida and didn't fit the profile. He was an upstanding businessman living in small-town Pennsylvania. Rick Leiches was a friend of presidents, a world-class aviation expert, and the mastermind who smuggled 10 tons of cocaine into the U.S., lining his pockets with millions.
He brought in more cocaine than any other drug smuggling ring in this country, and that's quite an achievement.
The question is, How did he do it? Rick Leitches is America's most successful smuggler, flying over $20 billion of cocaine into the U.S. From an early age, Leitches is obsessed with flight.
He just loved to fly. He got his pilot's license when he was still in high school. He was gifted at flying and at the mechanics of the planes.
After graduating college in the late 70s with a degree in aeronautics, Leitches starts a business in Scranton, Pennsylvania, called Air America. The company specializes in luxury upgrades to small planes.
If you're flying a plane to Canada, it's nice if you don't have to stop to refuel. Bring your plane to Rick, pay him $100,000, and he can outfit it.
The quality of work that came out of Air America was top-notch. It was excellent.
Air America was very well-known and had a very good reputation in the airline industry.
He was really good to his workers. He paid them a fair wage, more than a fair wage. They all liked him.
Rick donates to local charities, befriends the police, even flies the state governor around on business.
He ingratiated himself with politicians, with government officials, with leaders of the community.
Air America thrives until recession hits hard in 1980. Rick's corporate clients are replaced by shady characters requesting their planes be outfitted with hidden cargo space. One of them insists on paying his bill with a bag containing 3,000 quaaludes. Desperate for cash, Rick tries to sell them.
Well, his mechanic happened to know somebody down in Philly that could probably move these things. One of the first sales he made was to an undercover cop.
Rick is arrested and questioned. Authorities quickly determine he's a financially strapped businessman, not a serious dealer. But because the DEA suspects his company is being used by drug runners to modify their planes, they offer him a deal.
The DEA recruited him almost immediately off of that quaalude thing.
In return for dropping the charges, Leitches agrees to report any suspicious activity at Air America.
So he was kind of in the drug business, whether you liked it or not.
Rick realizes the DEA is right. Many of his clients are drug smugglers, and they're making millions more than him. Then in 1981, one of Rick's shady customers offers him a big payday to pilot for a Tampa pot smuggling ring. With Air America now on the brink of bankruptcy, Leitches accepts.
Long range goal, he wasn't going to stay in that business forever. At least that wasn't his original intent. His original intent was to make a little money, boost his business up so he could turn his back on smuggling.
But Rick quickly discovers the people he's hired to fly for are amateurs.
Most drug smugglers were people who used the merchandise themselves. They weren't the most stable, reliable people. He commented to his friends about how sloppy they were.
Fuel tanks sit dangerously exposed in the cabin. And the route he's forced to fly is crawling with DEA. But Leitches manages to land the plane and earn his money. After flying two more runs, he quits the ring. But his professionalism brings him to the attention of Jorge Ochoa.
Jorge Ochoa was one of the main members of the Medellin cartel, which was a group of individuals who controlled the cocaine coming into the United States. When you have access to a person like Jorge Ochoa and you work directly for him transporting his cocaine, you can't get any bigger than that.
Ochoa dazzles Rick with promises of millions and all the adventure he can handle, smuggling the cartel's cocaine. Still in desperate need of money, Rick accepts. But the Colombian leaves him with a warning.
If you cheat us, we'll kill you. Rick accepted that and came home.
The problem Leitches now faces is how to make the 6,000-mile round trip from Pennsylvania to Colombia. He knows landing to refuel during the voyage risks alerting authorities. But the only aircraft that can fly nonstop are large cargo planes.
Those airplanes get on the watch list right off. And eventually those airplanes get caught.
So Rick sets out to turn an innocent-looking Cessna 310, designed to fly 900 miles, into a long-distance superplane. The first step is to increase fuel capacity.
Rick took a plane that would normally carry 2,000 gallons of fuel and outfit them so they could carry 6,000.
But the government had law enforcement looking for airplanes that had tanks inside the cabin or suspicious-looking plumbing.
So Lychus stores extra fuel in rubber bladders, hidden in the nose, under the cabin floor, in the luggage compartments, and in hollow spaces in the wings.
The plane was basically a flying fuel tank.
To control the flow of fuel from these extra tanks, Lychus builds a centralized distribution system that supplies the engines evenly while maintaining aircraft balance. But with added fuel comes added weight.
Once you add that much fuel, you needed to reinforce the wings, you needed to reinforce the wheel struts, you needed to increase the strength of the engines. So he would put in engines with much more horsepower. Anyone looking at it would say there's no way that plane can fly from here to Colombia.
To avoid suspicion from authorities, Lychus obtains an FAA certificate declaring all the modifications perfectly legal.
And law enforcement doesn't have any probable cause to mess with the airplane.
Inside the cockpit, Rick installs custom-designed radar to alert him to weather conditions and government air patrols.
If Rick was a genius, it wasn't only equipping the planes, it was figuring out a way of evading the radar and drug enforcement system.
To defeat the DEA security dragnet, Lychus targets a crooked customs agent who sells him a list of radar locations, plus flight paths and schedules of all coastal patrol aircraft. He also sets up a radio network spanning two continents and develops a secret communications code to keep in contact with the cartel during flight.
No, he was very shrewd. He was very smart. He was very calculating. It was obvious he put a lot of thought in each step that he did.
Throughout his preparations, Rick is careful not to arouse the suspicion of his contacts in the DEA.
The agents got very close to Rick. Part of it was that he is a charming guy, and I think he charmed them.
Finally, after 3 months of planning, Rick takes off on his maiden voyage and flies a direct route to Colombia. 13 hours later, he arrives. While the Colombians load his plane with coke, Rick makes a careful calculation of the plane's new weight and the exact length and state of the runway.
The trouble is the fields that they were taking off from were generally unpaved. There were trees at the end.
After a short rest, Rick departs. His tiny plane carries 800 pounds of cocaine and is 2,000 pounds heavier than the recommended limit.
The plane had to struggle to get off the ground and clear those trees. And off the coast of Colombia, there are a lot of wrecks of planes that didn't quite make it.
The engine modifications and upgraded horsepower in Rick's plane get him safely airborne, but he doesn't return home by the same route. Instead, he takes a new flight path that authorities had never even considered, the 73rd Meridian.
He figured out that if he could equip the planes to fly further, he would stay out of the pattern of radar detection.
But 5 hours into the flight, Rick's custom-built aircraft detection system alerts him to a Navy tracker plane hot on his tail. Using his weather radar, he locates a nearby electrical storm.
if you're getting painted by radar and what you're worried about is being caught and going to the jail for the rest of your life, you might be willing to go into a storm, assuming that the law enforcement pilot's not going to do that.
To escape, Rick flies straight into the heart of the storm.
Rick was an outstanding pilot. If he wasn't the best drug smuggling pilot, he was damn close.
The Navy vessel refuses to follow and loses him on the radar. 2 hours later, Rick emerges from the storm and turns sharply inland. Flying below radar, he heads for an abandoned commuter landing strip. He approaches the runway, but instead of landing, he rises sharply to 1,500 feet. After flying 3,000 miles from Columbia, he appears on radar for the first time.
He would fly very low altitudes to penetrate the radar and pop up so he could look as though he's a normal airplane.
Rick then radios the Scranton control tower and has them log his flight as a brief commuter hop. Arriving safely home, he unloads 800 pounds of cocaine and collects over $1 million. His success, however, will be threatened when his Florida pot smuggling days come back to haunt him. Rick Leiches has been paid over $1 million by the Medellin cartel for smuggling 800 pounds of cocaine into the U.S. The cartel is so impressed, they have Rick make regular runs for them over the next year.
Rick was in it because it was an adventure, and the money allowed him to do the adventurous things that he wanted to do.
Gaining confidence, he now expands his operations, hiring extra pilots and increasing flights.
It's like you're feeding a mouse to a big cobra. If you're going to be really careful the first couple of times you do it. But if that cobra doesn't bite you, pretty soon you're just casually lifting the lid, throwing the mouse in and closing the lid. And you do that time and time again.
Leiches prides himself on the efficiency of the operation.
He used to joke that he was the Federal Express of the drug business.
Rick used to brag that he would be plus or minus 3 minutes of any time you told him anywhere in the world.
The first four trips we did, the Colombians were ready for us. When we were ready for the fifth trip, the Colombians told us we had to wait because we ran them out of product. They were giddy with the schedule.
They never lost a flight, never crashed. They always delivered on time. And the Colombians appreciated that. They even gave him a raise.
Meanwhile, the DEA, not realizing that Rick is a smuggler, lean on him for more information about the drug trade.
And he did manage to provide a lot of useful information, but it was very strategically chosen.
Then, in 1984, disaster strikes.
One day the cobra's pissed, and he bites you. You think. Why did that happen? That's never happened before.
The Tampa pot ring that Leiches flew his first smuggling runs with is busted. He is indicted along with 15 others and sent to Florida for trial.
Rick's defense was, yes, he flew those runs, but he was only doing that in order to gain information about this nasty drug ring for his friends in the government.
Leiches even convinces his DEA handlers to testify on his behalf.
They all either came down or wrote testimonials to his fine, upstanding character.
But Rick's biggest fear is the Colombians. To convince them that he's not ratting them out, he flies coke runs every weekend during the trial.
Each weekend he came home and dropped his lawyers off, hopped in the airplane and went to Colombia and brought a load back.
He'd bring in 200 to 300 kilos of coke, drop them off, get a little bit of sleep, and fly back down to Florida on Sunday to be ready to sit in trial again Monday morning. The trial lasted 11 weeks, and during that time he made 11 flights, smuggling cocaine.
Rick makes $13 million flying these drug runs, and is the only defendant the jury acquits. But Rick's enormous smuggling success leaves him with millions of dollars to launder. he enlists a corporate Scranton banker, Michael Coffey, to hide the cash offshore.
Michael Coffey helped launder Rick's money by not filling out the proper documentation.
Michael was ambitious, and he made a little extra for providing this service.
But Rick suddenly faces a bigger issue. Jim Cooper is in police custody. He has crashed his plane into the car of a man waiting to offload drugs and killed him.
Everybody says, I crashed the airplane on top of this car. And I say, this guy parked his car underneath my airplane. He had done cocaine all day long and was blissed out of his head, and he and I met in the middle of the runway.
When Cooper is charged with felony murder, his first call is to Rick Leitches.
Rick had the option of throwing a little money my way. He could have said, look, you need to disappear, go down the islands and get a tan for about 9 months. But he didn't choose that.
Jim was facing up to 20 years in jail, and instead he worked out a plea deal where he didn't get any jail time, and in exchange he provided information about Rick.
Armed with Cooper's confession, the DEA makes its move on Air America and Rick Leitches.
And the way we did that was what we referred to as following a paper trail. In other words, going after where he landed an airplane, finding out there was a gas receipt, where he purchased radio equipment, finding out there was receipts for that.
The feds also bring in a money laundering specialist to examine Rick's bank transactions. Realizing authorities are closing in, Leitches immediately wires $30 million to the Cayman Island of St. Eustatius and flees there himself.
St. Eustatius and a lot of the islands don't have extradition treaties with the United States.
Forensic accountants trace his money to the island, and the DEA appeals to local authorities.
Myself and another agent provided information showing that Rick was wanted back in the United States.
They prevailed upon the government there to deport him as an undesirable alien.
St. Eustatius law enforcement agrees to cooperate. In 1986, Rick is arrested by local police, taken to the airport, and handed over to the DEA.
They got him, put him on a plane, brought him back. When they got into U.S. airspace, they told him he was under arrest.
Rick is charged with conspiracy to smuggle cocaine. To avoid 345 years in jail, he cooperates with the investigation and reveals where he has hidden the cash.
He seized over $21 million in cash and or assets.
He also gives up his team, all of whom end up serving time. Rick himself goes to jail for 8.5 years.
Rick was a combination of Christopher Columbus and Charles Lindbergh.
Rick wasn't afraid to take a risk. He wasn't afraid to learn about something he knew nothing about.
Compared to anyone else in the drug business, he was a genius.
Bottom line is, he hurt a lot of people. I mean, you bring in 9 tons of cocaine, you're hurting people. You're hurting children. You're hurting families, you're hurting people.
Since his release, Rick Leitches has gone straight and started a new life in Florida.
Last thing I heard, he was living in a place called Smuggler's Cove. Very apropos.
Well, that was our first show of Masterminds. It was called Air America. These were recorded in about mid-2006, somewhere in that neighborhood. So they're a little dated. I'm sure there are some more criminal geniuses since 2006 that have better stories, maybe worse stories, or maybe the police have got everything under control now. It's hard to say. Well, anyways, while I'm on the topic of good guys versus bad guys, I thought there's a song I'd like to play in between the two shows by R. Dean Taylor. You'll probably remember it. Thank you.
say what he said about you. And it's so cold and lonely here without you. Out there the laws are coming. I'm scared so tired of nothing. Indiana wants me. Well, I can't go back there. Talk to you. It hurts to see the man that I've become, and to know I'll never see the morning sunshine on the land. I'll never see your smiling face or touch your hand. If just once more I could see you, our home and our little baby. Hang on, love, to the memories of those happy years. Red lights are flashing around me. Yellow, it looks like they found me.
High school student nearly crippled the nation's economy.
He was Canada's most notorious counterfeiter. His notes just exploded across the country.
It wasn't necessarily the money, it was the challenge.
He was a big player. It just mushroomed into so much more.
There was no way we were ever going to get caught. We were untouchable, invincible.
Find out how he did it next on Masterminds.
No!
In the late 1990s, Windsor, Ontario was hit with a flood of extraordinary counterfeit $100 bills.
The bills were perfect. They were passing the counterfeit detection, no problem. That's how good they were.
The forgers had somehow managed to defeat the world's most secure currency.
Canada's pretty much a leader in the security features on their notes.
Every aspect of a bill is in some way intended to ensure security.
Printed on non-fluorescent paper, the $100 note is made up of 9 different sections, each designed by individual engravers. Raised ink printing gives it a three-dimensional quality. The bill also contains extensive microprinting, intricate line patterns and shades, a color-shifting foil applique called the optical security device, and embedded fluorescent planchettes. Even the twin serial numbers employ a highly specialized font.
We really hadn't seen a major counterfeiter before, when it had implications across Canada.
The exceptional forgeries soon became epidemic, spreading to cities throughout the country and inflicting huge losses on businesses.
We started seeing refusal notices go up as a result.
No, we don't think so.
90% retailers would not accept a $100 bill because they perceived that it was just too risky.
Obviously, you want to find out who's manufacturing it so you can stop it. But you can't always judge where the bill's being made by going to the location where they're being passed.
Tracing it back is very difficult unless you get some information and do some old-fashioned legwork. We're looking for anything that we can to identify where they may come from.
Police across the nation launched a major crackdown on known and suspected counterfeiters.
We have people that have been caught passing counterfeit, but the amount that we seized wouldn't point to somebody who was a manufacturer.
As the investigation widened, authorities interviewed paper suppliers about any unusual purchases.
Banknote paper is not standard paper. And it's not really even technically paper. It's a cotton-linen blend.
But when suppliers couldn't provide any leads, law enforcement started looking for the high-end presses they assumed must have produced the near-perfect bills.
Most counterfeiting operations are typically done on professional printing equipment.
But again, police drew a blank.
There were only so many suspects around. No one had that expertise or the knowledge or the equipment.
Then, in early 2000, as authorities hit a dead end, the problem escalated. The entire nation was awash in $16 million in fake hundreds.
You're really attacking a country's economy when you're making counterfeit currency.
Investigators suspected the operation originated across the border with the Detroit mob. But the mastermind behind the greatest counterfeiting operation in Canadian history was the last person police ever imagined.
I had this notion embedded in the back of my head since I was a kid that if you could print money, you would solve all the problems in the world. I woke up one morning and decided I'm going to do the best counterfeit bill anybody's ever seen.
High school student Wesley Weber had found a way to create undetectable counterfeits and literally made himself millions. The question is, how did he do it? Master counterfeiter Wesley Weber was born in 1974, just south of Windsor, Ontario, in a small community called River Kennard.
My upbringing was better than most. I was afforded every opportunity growing up. As a young kid, my parents were extremely supportive, nurturing academically, but I was an introvert. I was a shy kid.
When Wesley Weber discovers computers, a whole new world opens up for him.
Computer was my first babysitter. It was the best thing ever invented. I spent more time with my computer than socializing through high school. I was a nerd. You know, pimples and glasses and the stereotypes that just make you insecure when you're young. What I had to figure out was a way to change my image.
Weber's need to make his mark leads him to commit a daring act.
The first big criminal thing that he did, he broke into a high school.
My friend and I had black clothes, black hats, all the stereotypes that go along with a Mission Impossible style robbery. We lowered ourselves in through the roof. We cut the power, we did all kinds of extravagant things to minimize our detection. We stole everything. My accomplice's parents were gone to Mexico. We had the whole house as a home base to stash our loot. The newspapers accounted professional burglars from Detroit had come and stole $270,000 worth of equipment. It was our vindication. We foolishly started bragging about what we did because if no one knew what we did, there was no point in doing it.
But Weber's conceit soon brings him to the attention of police.
He seized the equipment. He was arrested and he was charged and he was convicted.
My parents were in shock. They didn't know what to do. Mr. Overachiever is breaking into schools now. I went to jail for a week. It was a terrifying experience.
But Weber also discovers he's finally made his mark.
I went back to find I was the most popular guy in the school. I was feeling that acceptance I had sought after so long.
He's quickly befriended by fellow students Anthony Caporale, Dustin Cossum, and Ryan Hodair.
I drank, did drugs, never went to school, partied with the girls.
Weber moves in with the gang and soon learns how they support themselves.
And they're very involved in criminal activities.
Breaking into cars, taking radios, selling various illicit goods. And Weber finds the lifestyle exciting.
After the gang shows Weber their feeble attempts at check fraud, he demonstrates how to do a better job.
Got some genuine documentation, counterfeited, and put the information he wanted onto it.
The first check I counterfeited was a City of Windsor welfare check. I was pretty proficient at that time because of the graphics experience I had. So I came up with my own methodologies to manipulate the check, to change dates and addresses and account numbers.
His friends respected him because he had skills that they didn't. And if he could counterfeit things for them, then that would increase his standing.
The crew starts cashing his fake checks all over Windsor. But Weber's not satisfied.
And in the back of my head, there was always that thought that, well, why do we go through all this trouble to get money? Maybe we could just print money.
Wesley Weber now sets out to turn this idea into reality.
In 1999, Weber counterfeited his first currency.
Numbers have to be exact.
The first bills, they were substandard. It wasn't a simple process of just putting a bill in a scanner and pressing copy. It's a piece of engineering that's been created by dozens and dozens of people, and it requires extreme digital manipulation to have it come out as a reasonable facsimile. It took months and months and months to refine the process. It became an obsession. I was a perfectionist.
Against Weber's advice, his less discerning roommates insist on putting his substandard fakes to the test.
His buddies go around to retailers with a bunch of 20s and buy some small products, and they would pocket the actual money, and that was their profit.
But Weber wants more than small change.
I had a $100 note. It's the holy grail of the counterfeit world. It wasn't necessarily about the money for me, it was the challenge. There are 9 separate sections on a bill that are developed by individual engravers. I would edit the image, adjusting photographic attributes like sharpness, brightness, color, and hues and saturations. And I kept doing this week after week, month after month, to the point where I'd finally printed a front and back template. I started my proofs, printed them, they looked identical.
But they're still not good enough. The bills glow when placed under ultraviolet light, a dead giveaway that they're forgeries.
What you actually need is paper that is not UV responsive.
Posing as a bar owner, Weber now visits a Toronto paper manufacturer and explains his problem.
I walked in and I said, I print advertisements every Friday night with fluorescent lettering. And when I use my standard inkjet paper, the paper glows under my black lights in the bar and the letters glow.
And it looked awful and no one could read them.
She said, you need something called archival quality paper. I said, what's that? She said, it's acid-free, it's used in wills and testaments, deeds and ownerships, banknotes, and, I mean, that reverberated banknotes, you say.
Weber purchases a batch of the paper, then tackles his next obstacle.
The optical security device was the most challenging. It looked like a shiny chocolate bar wrapper. It looked like a piece of foil. That changes from gold to green.
He would call up foil producers. He would always hold himself out as the CEO of Pro Custom Graphics, which is a company, of course, that did not exist. He would use that as a way into the graphic arts business and the printing business.
Gentleman said, why do you want to get into the printing business? He said, there's no money in this. So I said, no, there's definitely money in this. We obviously had two different perspectives.
Determining it's too difficult to apply gold foil to his counterfeits, Weber scours art stores for a way to imitate the feature.
I happened to go to a place called Loomis and Toles. I said, I need a paint that changes color. Coincidentally, I had just received samples of this new paint. I took it home, put a dab on a bill that I had printed out, and it was unbelievable. I mean, it was almost identical. This was one of the hardest embedded security features that I had somehow thwarted with $3. Showed it to Dustin. His mouth almost fell out of his head. He was like, how did you do this? This is impossible.
Armed with the necessary materials, Weber makes a batch of notes and tests them on a vigilant store clerk.
She took each individual bill, curled the ends where the optical security device was to make sure there was a gradient of color that transitioned from gold to green. She took a magic marker out next. She used to test the acidity of paper. She placed each bill under the fluorescent light, and the planchette fluoresced. The last thing she did was pulled out a 10 times magnification glass and passed them as genuine. We left there skipping and jumping. We thought we had won the lottery. Now I was clearly on the other side of the law. I was living my own life, doing things my own way.
Weber and his crew now ramp up operations.
Dustin's job was to apply the planchettes. Ryan's job was to apply the optical security device. Anthony sprayed an entire page with clear coat to seal the ink and provide the depth of color we were looking for.
They're soon printing $20,000 a day.
And we're just a bunch of kids having a good time going out and buying clothes and cases of beer. I now had the social circle that I wanted. You know, I had access to all kinds of things in life that I'd never been exposed to before. It's just a very self-centered lifestyle, but it fed into that feeling of worth and self-esteem and self-confidence. No consideration of consequence, nothing.
But as Weber's fortune grows, so does his greed, and it soon threatens to bring him down. Canadian counterfeiter Wesley Weber now sets out to find a way to move his product across the country.
Weber sought out an individual who was involved in both legitimate and illegitimate businesses. It was someone he'd known for some years and who had expressed interest in his counterfeiting endeavors earlier on.
He said $180,000 tomorrow at 23%. There was no negotiating. We'd never printed that amount in one period of time.
But Weber and his gang rise to the challenge. They work through the night, deliver the counterfeits on time, and score over $40,000 profit. His fence soon places another larger order.
Now we had unlimited budgets to play with advanced software, and we had more efficient products. We were cutting 100,000 at a time with a hydraulic laser paper cutter. And I just kept increasing my level of sophistication. We literally put hundreds of thousands of dollars in the dryer with clay poker chips that would pit the edges of the paper, making it look torn and worn. It took about 11 minutes for $100,000 to run through the dryer. That was the first time tangibly we felt that, holy cow, maybe we could each make $100,000, maybe even each $1 million. That's when the greed really set in. I spent days shopping, constantly, 20 hours a day, and I was a madman.
They can go buy the cars they want. They can go buy the little toys that they want.
The girlfriend wanted a Cherokee. I picked up about $34,000 in real cash, went to the dealership, and picked out a Cherokee. There was no way we were ever going to get caught. We ran the world. We felt we were untouchable, invincible.
But the greedier they got, the more sloppy they got, they were being real cavalier.
Weber buys himself a top-of-the-line Mustang Cobra and can't resist loading it up with high-end modifications.
Weber went to London to buy some rims for his Mustang. The guy wanted $3,000 in cash. He said, no problem. But rather than taking the good money to buy the rims, he used his counterfeit money.
After Weber leaves, the dealer notices several of his bills have the same serial number and calls police.
So it starts there with the reporting of the bills. Wesley Weber was not the kind of guy we'd be looking at, but now we're going to look at him real hard.
They put a lot of manpower on this investigation. They put surveillance on Weber and his crew 24 hours a day.
On many occasions, we've seen the police following us. So everybody's life changed at that point. We became very suspicious.
Weber did all sorts of crazy things in order to make it more difficult for the cops to follow him. He drove erratically. He would pull spontaneous U-turns. He would go through lights.
We changed cell phones every 2 months. I had already been to jail once. I didn't want to go back. Jail scared the hell out of me.
But he can't say no when his fence comes calling.
He ordered another $100,000. And another $100,000. But we couldn't print it fast enough. There just wasn't enough time in the day. That greed that just pushed all of us over the edge.
They knew they were being followed, but they just wouldn't stop.
Hadn't slept in months, literally. I was worn out, just destroyed. Looked like I hadn't eaten in a half a year. People say it's quick money. It wasn't quick money. It was the most arduous time of my life. There was no way to get off the train at that point. Couldn't stop.
Desperate to shake police, Weber and his gang move operations to a new location.
They're trying to keep that location secret from the police, but the police were persistent.
While the mastermind stays a step ahead of the law, his associates aren't so lucky.
Police officers put GPS tracking devices on one of their vehicles.
Law enforcement tracks the crew back to their new hideout and sets up a stakeout right next door.
They had just followed them back from picking up gold paint, and they picked up all kinds of paper for the manufacturing of the bills.
After secretly observing every detail of the operation for weeks, police are ready to strike.
Go! 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 Police!
The bills are pouring out of the printers as the officers are going into the place.
Authorities seize over $250,000 in counterfeit hundreds. And enough paper to print millions more.
They were in shock. Two people with gold paint on their hands. When you catch someone in the act, it doesn't get much better than that.
At the point we were arrested, we had produced approximately $16 million in counterfeit money. Saturated the market pretty heavily. Our money was worldwide.
At trial, Ryan Hodair, Dustin Cossum, and Anthony Caporale are each sentenced to 2 years.
I was sentenced as the mastermind to 5 years.
Weber is the biggest counterfeit case in Canadian history.
People will probably never look at the $100 note the same way again.
In fact, it's the Weber bill that's being taught at the police colleges for fraud and counterfeiting. Weber's is the test case.
And there should be police spots all over the bill.
It's pretty rare to see that combination of determination and intelligence, which could have been applied to any number of disciplines. He chose to apply it to criminal activity.
At the time we were printing money, we weren't concerned as to the consequences of what we were doing.
Sooner or later, you're going to jail, and really, at the end of the day, is it worth it?
It's only rewarding until you get caught, and then you have to pay the full price, which is several years of your life.
For us, it was the overpowering feeling
that you were in complete control when in fact you had no control. The greed permeates things. There was no way for us to stop. It was our downfall.
Well, that was Masterminds, The Invisible Man. It's amazing to me how greed gets most of these guys. They become overconfident and they get greedy. They want more, they want more, they want more. You would think if you had such a great system for making money, you could just print yourself a small extra income and over time you'd have a decent lifestyle that probably wouldn't go noticed as being unusual. But anyways, those are just my thoughts on if it were me. But then again, I don't have the courage to take on anything like that. I don't particularly want to be in prison for the rest of my life. But those are a couple good shows. I enjoyed them, so I thought I would share them with you. I hope you enjoyed them. We'll see you next time here on MSS. And I'm going to leave you with another kind of good guy, bad guy song from another show that you probably won't be able to get out of your head tonight. But I'm going to play it, and that will be the outro for tonight. And enjoy.
What you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? When you were 8 and you had bad traits, you go to school and learn the golden rule. So why are you acting like a bloody fool? If you get hot, then you must get cool. Bad boys, what you gonna do? Oh, what you gonna do when they come for you? Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? You chuck it on that one, you chuck it on this one. You chuck it on your mother and you chuck it on your father. You chuck it on your brother and you chuck it on your sister. You chuck it on that one and you chuck it on me. Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? What you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Nobody now give you no break. Police now give you no break. That old soldier man now give you no break. Not even your eyes will now give you no breaks. Hey, hey. Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? You're too rude. What you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Bad boys, bad boys. What you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? You chuck it on that one, you chuck it on this one, you chuck it on your mother and you chuck it on your father, you chuck it on your brother and you chuck it on your sister, you chuck it on that one and you chuck it on me. Bad boys, bad boys. What you gonna do? What you gonna do?